an alien starship with an insatiable curiosity about Earth's science fiction and fantasy trivia. The crew, two hapless astronauts who have spent their lives immersed in strange new worlds of the imagination. Now, Rob Wickings and Clive Ashenden roam the universe, trying to find the way home, seeking to define the A to Z of SFF.
'90s, don't you love the 90s? It's so full of great stuff. The 1990s, that is, not the 2190s. They were terrible, but all the 2290s, they were fun. But, you know, the 1990s, there's loads of good stuff going on then. I want to talk about a brilliant, but really strange and a bit dirty and but fun movie that came out in 1990. And it's a film about a robot who becomes an artwork and then stops being an artwork and becomes a killer. And it's great, and it's called Hardware. So let's talk about that, shall we?
Yeah, let's talk about Hardware. 1990, as Curiosity so accurately puts it, written and directed by Maverick filmmaker Richard Stanley.
Yes, he of, well, at that time, mainly music video fame, but subsequently the director of Dust Devil and the, parts director of the infamously misaligned, cursed production of The Island of Dr. Moreau.
Ooh, boy, howdy. Now, the Dr. Moreau is one of those films where the story about the making of the film is actually much more interesting than the film itself. So who knows, maybe at some point in the not too distant future, we might talk about that one as well. But no, we're here today to talk about Richard Stanley's first feature, probably arguably his most, well, certainly the one he's best known for, Hardware, which is... it's a great sleazy little piece of cyberpunk, I guess you'd call it. It's certainly got that sort of 90s science fiction feel all over it, wouldn't you say, Clive?
Yes, you might also say that it's a bit of a love letter to Blade Runner and certainly that aesthetic.
Mm-hmm. Yep, definitely. It's that really heavily, deeply encrusted future we're talking about here, where everything seems to have a slightly malfunctioning analog monitor hooked into it, and all sorts of keyboards, and it seems like you need to be able to run command line just to be able to boil a kettle.
Well, that was very much what it was like on the Ulysses, wasn't it, Rob? But
certainly was.
But no, it does have that kind of really sort of grungy dirt under the nails. This is a broken future. This is not a shiny 1950s. Everyone's wearing, sort of brand new space helmets and everything's in, you know, covered in shiny tinfoil. It's very much that sort of dirty, reused sort of tech that's scavenged and indeed, that's the scavenging is a key part of the plot here.
Absolutely. I mean, the future that we're in here is kind of an unspecified date, but it's a future that's we're clearly a long way into a very damaging war that's basically quietly killing. Well, it's not quietly killing the planet; it's very loudly killing the planet. But radiation is everywhere. there's an inference that the government's basically putting a hold on breeding, weirdly enough. There's a little subplot in the story about a government bill to actually either sterilize people or to stop them from having kids, largely because the radiation that's kicking around in the atmosphere is so harsh that any kids that are being born would be mutants. So it's a pretty bleak future that we're looking at here.
Yeah, and there's a very 2000 AD vibe about the whole thing, which is slightly unsurprising in some ways, but in that, you know, everyone is sort of living in these sort of heavily armored tower blocks, some of which have just completely gone to kind of chaos, and others are sort of just about hanging on as these sort of little islands of civilization in the, you know, in the increasingly sort of broken society.
Within this context, what we basically, Hardware is at its heart basically a quite neatly contained little horror story about. Well, there's three main characters basically. There's the heroine who's an artist who's basically holed herself up in one of these tower blocks. She's sealed herself away and works on sort of sculptures in metal and sort of found materials. Her boyfriend, who's a space pilot, who basically brings her some found materials that he picks up from a scavenger in the wild, rad-riddled wastelands. And indeed, the material of that sculpture is the third character, the villain of the piece, the harbinger of the piece, is an abandoned, broken-up prototype war droid who manages to repower itself and goes looking for victims.
Yeah, it's definitely, you know, chiefly I guess that sort of three-hander, as you say. You've got Jill, played by Stacey Travis, and Moses Baxter, played by Dylan McDermott, which is a great cyberpunk name, isn't it? And then around this sort of central triad, you have all these other supporting characters, you know, some of which, let's face it, are in there so that there are people for the killer droid to kill.
Cannon fodder, definitely.
Yeah. But there's also some really nice sort of character work. You've got John Lynch playing Shades, the sort of best buddy of Moses, and someone who clearly carries a bit of a candle for Jill.
I mean, there's an awfully sleazy feel to the whole thing. So you've got characters like Charles Dunning, who plays the guy who's sort of peeping on Jill from across the way.
I don't think so. No, is that Lincoln Weinberg Jr.? Is that the character, or am I getting mixed?
That's Lincoln. Yeah, Lincoln Weinberg. Yeah, Jr.
He's played by William Hootkins.
William Hootkins, of course. I always get those two mixed up.
He does have a very Charles Dunning type look to him, to be fair.
He does, and yeah.
I mean, he's literally smacking his lips as he's perving on her and sending sort of dirty video calls, and it's very unsettling. But as it's supposed to be. He gets his comeuppance.
Certainly does, yep. So the whole thing, as I've said before, the whole thing is just once it actually gets going, it's a really neat, contained little horror movie. But before it gets to that point, you've kind of got almost the first half of the movie is pretty much all set up and sort of explanation of the world in which we're set, which strikes me as a bit of a shame. Although you do get a great chance to look at the fantastic production design that Richard Stanley's put in throughout. As we said earlier, it's very much a love letter to that sort of crusted retro future of Blade Runner, and for a reasonably low budget movie, every cent of the budget is on screen, and it's got this grungy charm to it, definitely.
Yeah, I think this is one of those occasions where, in this, where the director has actually had a dry run at this first. He made an 8mm film, which is about 45 minutes long, I think, called Incidents in an Expanding Universe, which he made like 5 years prior to Hardware. And it's essentially got a lot of the same characters and plot elements, only without the killer robot, if you can imagine.
Right.
So it's basically the story of this soldier he's called Max, and this sculptress who sculpts things using metal found objects. Sound familiar? And how they're trying to maintain a relationship in this broken post-apocalyptic world. And it's sort of told in this non-linear fashion. And you also got, there's also a character called Shades in there. There are all these various sort of visual things that come back in. So, you know, if you're a big fan of Hardware, it's you can kind of go back and look at the kind of progenitor. But it's interesting, you know, how there's certain kind of elements, you know, were sort of developed prior to that, but also it's very clear why Steve McManus and Kevin O'Neill get a story credit, isn't it, Rob?
Very much so. We mentioned 2000 AD earlier on, and the resemblance between Richard Stanley's script and that of 2000 AD Future Shock called Shock, S-H-O-K exclamation mark, were kind of a little bit too close together to be anything but actionable, which is what McManus and Gosling did, and subsequently ended up with a story credit on the film. And it is it's really interesting to see that basically what you've got in the 7-page 2000 AD strip that they wrote is basically the best bits of Hardware condensed into this really neat, sharp little piece of storytelling. That's probably the big problem that I have with Hardware, is that even though it's barely 90 minutes long, it does feel a little on the, well, it's slow paced. It does feel a bit bloated. It does feel like it takes an awfully long time for anything really to start happening. Once it does, it's great, and it does motor along quite merrily. And you've got and the production design, as I say, is great. The robot itself, the killer, the shock killer, is very, very well realized. But you know, 40 minutes to get to the first kill of the film does seem to it takes a while.
It does, and there's a certain amount of, you feel that the filmmaker is in love with this, with certain visuals, and wants to dwell on them or just sort of show you this world he's created. And you know, whilst I appreciate that to a certain extent, there's a certain, as you say, there is that certain, why don't we get on with this? And also there are some parts where you feel like the storytelling's just a little bit vague, for want of a better word. It's just sort of, you're like, well, why is this scene in here? It's just sort of telling me bit more about the sort of background of the world, but it's not actually moving anything on. And I think they seem to be trying to sort of set up that this relationship between Jill and Moses, which is a bit on off, a bit uneasy, because she's almost like a shut-in. She's walled herself off, and you know, it's kind of got tired of him constantly going away, you know, ostensibly for work, but actually partly he just likes to sort of be out in the wilds of the kind of like nomad land, and this is this source of tension, you know, and it's sort of, I feel like the movie can't really make up its mind who the lead character is as well, which, you know, so when you actually get to the climax, and it does make a choice, then it works, then suddenly you sort of, as you say, you're nailed in. But initially, is it like, is this Moses' story? Is this Jill's story? it's sort of a bit all over the shop.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I like to think that it is kind of Jill's story, but even so, you don't really see her until, God, possibly 20 minutes into the film. And the fact that, I mean, she is pretty much the final girl in it, but you still get these moments where it's like, even though she's obviously the one that does fight back ingeniously against the hardware robot, you still get those sort of moments where Moses comes in all guns blazing and seems to save the day, and then he doesn't. And yeah, it's there's at least three different endings in the film as well, and then it just suddenly seems to just abruptly end. So yeah, there's very much a sense of it being a little bit unstructured, I guess, and a little bit just, as you said, quite vague, really.
Yeah, I mean, it's nice that Lemmy has a cameo as a taxi driver in there, and it's kind of cute that he goes, "Hey, you got to listen to these guys," and puts a cassette of Motorhead in playing Ace of Spades. You know, is it a bit too cute? You know, is it absolutely necessary? I mean, I guess you need him to get from A to B and show a bit more of the city, but yeah, it's fine. Yeah, so you've got Lemmy, and also you have Iggy Pop as Angry Bob on the radio. Yeah.
Yeah. Also, the other music connection, if you're a bit of a goth like what I am still, unfortunately, Carl McCoy of the Fields of the Nephilim makes an appearance as the weird scavenger type that Mo buys the hardware from in the first place. And he's in the full Nephilim get up with the sort of cowboy hat and the glowing contacts and all that stuff. So there's an awful lot of sort of odd, skewed little musical references kicking around throughout a film that was kind of described as an MTV science fiction movie when it initially came out. So there you go.
Yeah, you can see why, what with all, you know, there's lots of coloured light, there's lots of red in this film.
Definitely.
Yeah. So it has a very MTV aesthetic about it. Not in terms of the cutting, interestingly, but just in terms of the lighting.
Yeah, definitely. It's a richly decorated, richly coloured frame throughout, which is great. Yeah, all over that, definitely. You know, I do like a cluttered frame, and there's a lot to drink in hardware.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, it is. There isn't a lot of story for your, even in what is quite a short running time. But there are a lot of incidental pleasures, and I think the leads are perfectly fine. I would like, Jill to have a bit more kind of characterization. You know, for all this sort of, you know, pootling about before they get on with it, you know, I don't really feel like I get to know her that well.
No.
And then a lot of the way we first see her is in a very objectifying way, because we're getting that POV of the sleazy neighbor character.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, there's certainly an amount of cheesecake in there, but yeah, this is 1990s genre filmmaking, and you do get an awful lot of that in there. So it's perfectly watchable. It's by no means a masterpiece, and I think people do accept it as such, but it's got a real verve and a real charm to it, and obviously a lot of sort of incidental interest around the people who were involved in it. Obviously, you've got special effects from people like Chris Cunningham and Steve Norrington, who went on to do loads more interesting stuff with robots and mechanical special effects and things like that. Like I said, always interesting to see like these little cameos from sort of musical legends, I guess, for want of a better word. You know, Iggy Pop never actually appears on screen, but as a voiceover, that sort of DJ thing works well. It's worth your time. It's you know, I think you might want to, you probably find yourself skipping forward a little bit before, you know, certainly up to the halfway point before the kills start. But once the kills start, then you're in for certainly a fun 45 minutes, if nothing else.
Yeah, definitely. Although I would absolutely recommend the original Shock story from 2000 AD, because it's funny. I've watched as many times as I've watched Hardware, and I do enjoy it. The final panel of Shock has probably stayed with me longer, because it has a slightly different ending to the film Hardware. Has a really nice twist in the tail reveal, as you might expect from a few Shock story.
Yeah, definitely. It's inevitably we're just going to go back and sort of say, well, you know what? If you like the film, the book's better. In this case, I think the short story, the future Shock that it all came from is definitely a much cleaner, sharper distillation of the story there, because effectively anyone that's going to watch Hardware is looking for killer robot after girl action, and Shock, the future Shock, gives that to you in spades. So there you go. That's our recommendation, really. So Curiosity, have we given you what you need on Richard Stanley's flawed but fascinating Hardware?
Oh, guys, thank you so much. Yes, it's a fun little story, isn't it? And it's got lots of really interesting little bits. And I love all the sort of speak, kind of analog screens and all the keyboards everywhere, and everything's got about six different layers of cruft on it, and you know, that's fine, that's all good fun. And yes I really enjoyed it, so I hope everyone out there in Aidstead land enjoyed it too. So we're gonna go whizzing off to off to the robot planet of shock and awe. That sounds like fun, doesn't it? So let's do that, and we'll see you all soon. Okay, right, starting up the engines. Okay, see you later, guys. Bye!
A to Z of SFF was written and performed by Rob Wickens and Clive Ashenden, with additional voice talents of Maria Thomas. Music and editing are by Daniil Hallow of the Creation Station of Cavishing, all the way form you can eat. Do you want to know more? Search for the A to Z of SFF on iTunes, Facebook and Twitter, or check out www.theatozofff.com.